of self-driving vehicles in both Pennsylvania and Arizona. Google, Apple, and many other conventional car companies are conducting similar trials. By the time you read this, we will be ever closer to the reality of self-driving cars on our roads. The logic for this enormous investment in the technology of self-driving cars, particularly from Uber's point of view, is chillingly obvious. Uber's future depends greatly on solving self-driving, the technology website Recode explains. Taking drivers out of the equation would also increase the company's profits. Self-driving cars give Uber 100% of the fare. The company would no longer have to subsidize driver pay, and the cars can run nearly 24 hours a day. And, as you'll remember, the Columbia University economist Jeffrey Sachs warns us that there is now an urgency to the issue of technological unemployment, not just in transportation, but throughout every sector of the economy. So, what should we do when private superpowers like Uber make 100% of their profit by replacing their 1.5 million drivers with smart machines? How can we fix a future in which algorithms replace not only vast swatches of the manual labor force, but also skilled workers like lawyers, doctors, and engineers? As the most serious long-term problem on the horizon, this is fast becoming the great debate of the 21st century. But it isn't an entirely new issue and may not require a new solution. Indeed, 500 years ago, Thomas More, responding to disruptive changes in the 16th century agricultural economy that created greedy and fierce sheep, which, as he so memorably described, devour human beings, had already come up with a fix to this problem. So, to begin our conversation about this issue, let's return to the island idol founded by King Eutopus, that familiar no-place in the middle of nowhere. Chapter 10. Education. The Happiness of Life. In Thomas More's utopia, there are no languid idlers, no cesspool of worthless swashbucklers, no great lazy gangs of priests, no lusty beggars. Everybody, even women, works. But nobody works more than 6 hours a day. 3 hours in the morning, 3 in the afternoon. And the rest of the day, More explains, is left to each person's individual discretion. There are rules, such as no roistering or sloth, so people mostly spend their spare time either in intellectual activity, such as attending educational public lectures, or pursuing their own trade. In the evening, after a communal supper, people devote an hour to recreation, such as gardening or exercising. Finally, before bed, utopians either play music and games or engage in conversation. In an ideal society, More is saying, work matters, but leisure matters even more. The chief aim of their constitution is that, as far as public needs permit, all citizens should be free to withdraw as much time as possible from the service of the body and devote themselves to the freedom and culture of the mind, he explains. For in that, they think, lies the happiness of life. In utopia, therefore, the goal is to liberate people from the daily grind of their trades, so they have more time to improve themselves. It's akin to Karl Marx's youthful vision, laid out in the German ideology, of creating a post-revolutionary society in which technology will liberate us so that we can hunt in the morning, fish in the afternoon, rear cattle in the evening, and criticize after dinner. The aim is to nurture citizens who garden, exercise, play music, and converse with one another. That's the real work on More's imaginary island. The ultimate goal is to pay people to do nothing except make themselves better citizens. Utopia, then, is a kind of never-ending school designed to improve its inhabitants. And More, as the author of Utopia, is a teacher, too. He's raising consciousness among his readers, encouraging us to imagine a place where one can learn how to become a better human being. 500 years after the publication of Utopia, More's Renaissance humanism, with its focus on realizing the happiness of life, is back in vogue. It never went away completely, of course. In the 19th century, a youthful Karl Marx kept it alive. Today, however, rather than utopia or communism, it now goes under the name of universal basic income. This is the idea that, in our age of rising technological unemployment and inequality, the government will give all its citizens, rich and poor, young and old, male and female alike, a living wage, whether or not they have a job. Money for nothing, one headline about universal basic income thus says. Sighing for paradise to come, declares another about the future as a cornucopia of technological abundance in which paid work is optional and no one goes without. Paradise or not, everyone today, it seems, both inside and outside Silicon Valley, is talking about universal basic income as the fix to the looming joblessness crisis of our smart machine age, in which we will all become members of what Yuval Noah Harari calls the useless class. Its many proponents include libertarian technologists, like the Y Combinator CEO Sam Altman, who is funding a trial in Oakland around it, as well as more traditional progressives, such as the American labor organizer Andy Stern, the former president of the Service Employees International Union, who has written a book in favor of its implementation in the United States. Local and national governments all over the globe, from Canada and Finland to Brazil, Holland, and Switzerland, are experimenting with referendums or pilot projects to reinvent the social security systems of the industrial age. In a world caught between the operating systems of the industrial and digital ages, it is, as the Financial Times innovation editor John Thornhill summarizes, referring to a notion that, over the last 500 years, has impressed thinkers as diverse as Moore, Thomas Paine, John Stuart Mill, Friedrich Hayek, and Milton Friedman, an old idea with modern appeal. Given the central role of creative education in Utopia, it's not surprising that the Swiss political activist, Daniel Straub, one of the world's most successful evangelists of universal basic income, is a former teacher. Straub once taught at a Zurich school that was based on the pedagogical ideas of the early 20th century Italian educational reformer, Maria Montessori. A critic of the rigid discipline and rote learning methods of traditional schools in industrial Italy, Montessori pioneered an education system that prioritized a child's self-initiative through creative work. Just as Thomas More believed in the value of hands-on learning, Montessori, who established her first school in Rome in 1907, believed that kids are best developed through the training of both their minds and their senses. Her revolutionary schools, therefore, did away with grade levels and desks and the traditional classroom, introducing a program of manual arts, gardening, keeping house in a model kitchen, gymnastics, and creative game playing, designed to spontaneously nurture a lifelong self-discipline in the students. The system was originally dismissed by traditional educators as utopian, but there are today some 20,000 Montessori schools in 110 countries around the world, including 5,000 in the United States. Two of the best-known Montessori graduates are Google co-founders Sergey Brin and Larry Page. It's appalling. Our schools are from the industrial age, from 200 years ago. Straub, the father of a young child, complains to me about Switzerland's traditional schools, which he says encourage a stifling conformity in children. In contrast, his experience as a Montessori teacher confirmed his faith in human nature. In Montessori schools, he tells me, the kids aren't passive. Instead, he insists, they have an inner drive to do things. I am meeting with Straub at his cramped first-floor office, above a store that sells Christian iconography on the Augustinergasse, a winding cobbled lane in the medieval heart of Zurich. The old building, he tells me, built in 1365, was originally the home of the town's trumpet player. But music, he explains, was banned during the Reformation, and so the Augustinergasse house, like the rest of Zurich, remained silent for most of the 16th century. During the Reformation, the great debate was about free will rather than universal basic income. All over 16th century northern Europe, from England, Belgium, and Germany, to Swiss cities such as Geneva, Basel, and Zurich, the conversation was about the role of human agency. It pitted Renaissance figures like Erasmus, More, and Holbein against populist preachers like Martin Luther and Huldrych Zwingli, the Swiss priest who initiated the Reformation in Zurich. It was a debate, you'll remember, between humanists, who believed that we have freedom to shape our own histories, and those religious fanatics who believed in the existentially disempowering idea of predestination. Today, half a millennium later, that debate has been reframed as one between technological determinists and those like Edward Snowden, who believe in the primacy of human agency in determining the future. Daniel Straub is himself an advertisement for the humanist argument that we do indeed have the freedom to shape the future. In 2007, he discovered that what he describes, in good Mittel-European fashion, as his calling, was to increase human consciousness through the pursuit of universal basic income. Most people see high unemployment as the problem, Straub tells me. But for him, smart machines are actually liberating. Machines can free us to do what we want, he says, echoing Thomas More's argument in Utopia that leisure matters more than work. They can, he suggests, help us switch the music back on in our lives. Technology, Straub argues, is dramatically altering the nature of work and employment. My father had one job in his life. I have had six jobs, and my child will have six jobs at the same time, he explains. That's why, he thinks, we need the security of a basic income. It will give us what he calls a platform, or a foundation, to creatively navigate this turbulent new working environment. And so, Daniel Straub went to work on fixing the future. His goal, so to speak, was to transform Switzerland into a giant Montessori school, where everyone would be free to transform work into rigorous play. As in More's Utopia, Straub wanted to create the conditions for the happiness of life in Switzerland. In 2012, he and a small group of fellow activists began collecting signatures for a referendum on introducing an unconditional basic income pilot program. Under the Swiss Constitution, to achieve the referendum, they needed 100,000 signatures, which they collected by 2013. In the end, they got 120,000 people to sign the petition, 2% of the entire Swiss adult population. In June 2016, the Swiss voted on a referendum, the first vote of its type in the world, requesting a basic monthly income of 2,500 Swiss francs, U.S. $2,514, to all adults, and 625 francs, U.S. $629, to every child. You'd think, Thomas More says of Utopia's economy, that the necessities of life would be in scant supply, in an economy where people work so little, and where indeed there is neither private property nor money. But actually, he reassures us, utopians have more than enough of the necessities and even the conveniences of life, because everyone on the island contributes to the common good. Straub's economics for his proposal are similar. To pay for the reform, he intended to redistribute a third of the annual Swiss GDP, with the other two-thirds being untouchable. So, as in Utopia, everyone in Switzerland would contribute something toward the common good. Although Straub lost the 2016 referendum with 77% of the Swiss voters going against his idea, he still sees in the vote a great victory. First, he reminds me, there were neighborhoods of Zurich in which a majority of the voters were in favor of the proposal. Second, and most important, he succeeded in raising consciousness about reinventing social security in the 21st century. Like Thomas More, Daniel Straub has put Utopia on the map. Before the referendum, he tells me, nobody in Switzerland had ever heard of a universal basic income. And now, he says, smiling broadly, everyone has. Anyway, Straub predicts it's only a matter of time before we will be forced to implement some sort of radical reinvention of an industrial welfare system that is increasingly obsolescent. The problem, he explains, is that economic growth can't keep up with productivity. There's no doubt in my mind, he thus says, that at some point we will have basic minimum income. Many other thinkers share Straub's confidence in the inevitable radical reinvention of our industrial social security system. From Zurich, I fly to Amsterdam to meet with another of Europe's leading champions of the basic minimum income, Rutger Bregman. Originally from Utrecht, the Dutch city that is pioneering a 2017 scheme to pay its residents an unconditional monthly stipend, Bregman is the author of the aptly named Utopia for Realists, How We Can Build the Ideal World, a best-selling polemic in favor of universal basic income, which has been translated into 20 languages. As we sit in a cafe outside Amsterdam Central Station on an unseasonably warm April afternoon, the youthful Bregman lays out the case for a universal basic income, reiterating the core message in his book that we need, in his words, to control the future. Bregman, like Daniel Straub, celebrates the disappearance of what he calls bullshit jobs that dumb us down and drain us of our humanity. Above all, however, Bregman argues that we live in radically disruptive times that require what he calls big ideas if we are to successfully reinvent the industrial welfare system of benefits. The old left, in particular, he tells me, is intellectually bankrupt, which may explain why many traditional socialists, particularly in the labor unions, haven't embraced the universal basic income idea. The case for a universal basic income is also shared by many technologists and entrepreneurs who see it as an essential feature, perhaps even the central social security pillar of tomorrow's networked society. Robin Chase, the former CEO of both Zipcar and Buzzcar, and a leading evangelist for the sharing economy, tells me that universal basic income represents a kind of investment that will allow us to tap into people's talents. There will, she promises me, be a huge uptick in happiness, creativity, and productivity after its introduction. More ominously, Stowe Boyd, a Boston-based influential technology commentator and researcher who describes himself as a post-futurist, warns me that unless we introduce universal basic income, there will be homelessness 16 deep in the streets. Worse still, Boyd forecasts the eruption of a popular revolution he dubs the Human Spring by the mid-2020s if we don't address this issue now. One of the world's leading authorities on technological unemployment is Martin Ford, the Silicon Valley-based author of the acclaimed Rise of the Robots, Technology and the Threat of a Jobless Future, which won the Financial Times Business Book of the Year Award in 2015. Over lunch at a Greek restaurant packed with tech workers in the Silicon Valley city of Sunnyvale, Ford tells me that he imagines the tipping point in terms of mass unemployment will come in 15 or 20 years' time, with the crisis hitting low and high-wage jobs in parallel, particularly such service center jobs as driver, store assistant, and office worker. Nothing is off the table, Ford says, explaining the impact of smart technology on employment. All the politicians talk about jobs coming back, he says bluntly, but they aren't. And so, like everyone else, he believes that the easiest, most realistic solution is the universal basic income. He thinks it needs to start small in experimental pilot programs and be phased in gradually through the raising of broad-based taxes, including a carbon tax and a value-added tax, VAT. Like Robin Chase, Ford believes that this will encourage more people to be creative. Not everyone can become an entrepreneur, he tells me. But if you give people safety nets, he says, they'll take more risks. Everywhere the message is the same. But few make the argument as idealistically as Albert Wenger, Brad Burnham's partner at Union Square Ventures and, along with Burnham and John Borthwick, one of New York City's most prescient startup technology investors. The Bavarian-born, American-educated Wenger makes universal basic income, which he calls economic freedom, one of the three essential freedoms in what he calls, in his 2016 book, A World After Capital. But giving people this monthly stipend isn't in itself the solution, Wenger says. It has to be accompanied by his other two freedoms. The second, informational freedom, refers to a re-decentralized internet featuring peer-to-peer companies such as the micro-patronage network Patreon, which provides a platform for the buying and selling of creativity. And the third freedom is psychological freedom, which is rooted in what he calls self-regulation, by which he means the ability to master oneself. So in Albert Wenger's Utopia, economic freedom buys us the time to be creative, psychological freedom gives us the discipline to create, and informational freedom gives us the operating system to buy and sell that creativity. What matters is that they exist in combination. Together, they represent Wenger's ideal operating system for a world after capital, in which he promises the only scarcity will be our attention. Like Daniel Straub, Wenger sees a reinvented education system as critical to fixing our more short-term future. This ability to master oneself, to balance the rational and emotional sides of the brain, he tells me, when I visit him at the Union Square Ventures office on Broadway in downtown New York City, is super important, particularly on the internet, with its illusion of infinite freedom. Like Straub, he believes that the current educational system is mostly broken, because it fails to teach children how to achieve this psychological freedom. And so his three teenage children, who are all homeschooled by Wenger and his wife, the serial tech entrepreneur Susan Danziger, spend their time reading books on Stoic philosophy, neuroplasticity, and Buddhism in preparation for their adult lives. But homeschooling isn't practical for many working families, and very few parents offer the economic resources or intellectual firepower of Albert Wenger and Susan Danziger. So how can we fix the broken education system? And what, exactly, should we be teaching kids in order to prepare them for a life in which they might either be permanently unemployed and relying on their monthly universal basic income stipend, or multitasking six jobs simultaneously? What are humans good for? And so finally, we've arrived at the question of education. Education, we are told, particularly by those who don't teach or work in schools, is the answer. Education is how people are supposed to be retrained to work in the new economy. Education is where kids develop Albert Wenger's psychological freedom in order to break their online addictions. Education, to borrow some of Daniel Straub's language, is where we learn to be human. And though none of this is exactly wrong, the problem is that education has become the default solution to everything. When we don't know how to solve a big problem, we shove it into the classroom and make underpaid and overworked teachers responsible for fixing it. The bigger and more amorphous the problem, the more we hand it off to schools to fix. So, for example, in their excellent best-selling, The Second Machine Age, about the economic impact of Moore's Law on society, the MIT economists Erik Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee make education their number one policy recommendation for solving the American future. Teach the children well, Brynjolfsson and McAfee conclude, speaking of the need to pay teachers better, and make them more accountable for their pedagogical work, particularly the teaching of hard-to-measure skills like creativity and unstructured problem-solving. Teachers should also, Brynjolfsson and McAfee advise, use new technology such as massive open online courses, MOOCs, to enable low-cost replication of the best teachers' content and methods. The truth, however, in America at least, is that the children aren't being taught well. A May 2017 Pew Research Center report, The Future of Jobs and Jobs Training, asked 1,408 senior American executives, college professors, and AI experts a series of questions about the challenges of educating people for an automated world. The Pew report found that 30% of them expressed no confidence that schools, universities, and job training will evolve sufficiently quickly to match the demand for workers over the next decade. Bosses believe your work skills will soon be useless, the Washington Post bluntly concluded about the report. People are wrestling with this basic metaphysical question. What are humans good for? Lee Rainey, the study's co-author and the director of the Pew Research Center, said in response to the report, "It's important to figure that out because this blended world of machines and humans is already upon us, and it's going to accelerate." So, what exactly are humans good for? Especially when compared with the smart machines that, according to Pew's Lee Rainey, are eating humans' jobs. I pose this question to Nicholas Carr. Among America's most respected writers on the human costs of the digital revolution, the author of the Pulitzer Prize-nominated The Shallows, and several other powerful books about technology. Over a dinner of Central Asian food at a funky Tajikistani tea house in Boulder, Colorado, where Carr now lives, he talks metaphysics to me. While he admits to being irritated when people label him a humanist, he nonetheless offers a very vivid contrast between human beings and smart machines. There's no gray zone in computers. They can't be ambivalent, and they can't be programmed to deal with ambiguity. Nor do they have intuition, he explains. Like Stephen Wolfram, who, you'll remember, denies that computers will ever have goals, Carr believes that it's highly implausible that smart machines can become self-aware and acquire their own consciousness. And the great thing about human consciousness in comparison with a robot, he adds, taking a swig of beer, is that we can do different things simultaneously. But how do we teach the children well? I ask him. What are the skills we should be teaching our kids so that they will have not only jobs, but also relevance to what Pew's Lee Rainey calls the blended world of machines and humans? Carr talks about Toyota's recent announcement that it is replacing robots with skilled craftsmen at some of its Japanese factories. Toyota has recognized that these workers have years and years of experience, which enables them to understand the constant ambiguity of the workplace. The same is true of the intuition that doctors have acquired over many years of physically working with their patients. None of this intuition, he explains, can be represented by an algorithm. Carr's focus is on what Matthew Crawford, another popular American writer, describes as shop class as soul craft. Carr is suggesting, like Thomas More, that the uniquely human value of a trade lies in its practice. Education, then, Carr argues, sounding not unlike Maria Montessori, shouldn't just be about knowing, it's also about doing. So that, according to Nicholas Carr, is what humans are good for in an age of increasingly smart machines. The challenge and opportunity for educators, then, is to teach everything that can't be replicated by a robot or an algorithm. For Carr, with his vision of the profound limitations of computers, that includes the nurturing of intuition, ambiguity, and self-awareness. For Daniel Straub, the former Montessori educator, it is the teaching of consciousness and the idea of a calling. And for Union Square Ventures' Albert Wenger, who is homeschooling his three teenagers, it's teaching the self-mastery enabled by psychological freedom. This is the humanist ideal of education Moore laid out 500 years ago in Utopia. It's the teaching of the unquantifiable, how to talk to one's peers, how to realize self-discipline, how to enjoy leisure, how to think independently, how to be a good citizen. But does this kind of innovative education really exist in the world today? Or is it, like Moore's imaginary island, a fictional idea without any grounding in reality? Escaping the Silos. After my lunch with Martin Ford at the Greek restaurant in Sunnyvale, I drive a few miles north on US 101 to Palo Alto High School. This publicly funded school, situated over the road from Stanford University, lies in the epicenter of Silicon Valley, the risk-taking capital of the world. It is the high school to which tech titans like Steve Jobs send their kids to be educated. In spite of that troubling 2017 Pew report about the poor quality of teaching in America, there fortunately remain some innovative school teachers who are successfully preparing their students for a future dominated by smart machines. I've come to Palo Alto High to talk to one of California's most acclaimed high school teachers about her pedagogical methods. Esther Wojcicki, or Woj, as she is popularly known, has taught journalism at Palo Alto High since 1984. She founded the school's 24,000-square-foot Media Arts Center, which today, with its 600 students and 9 publications, is the largest digital media program in the United States. She was selected as the California Teacher of the Year in 2002 and has won numerous other local and national teaching awards. And she is the co-author of Moonshots in Education, a 2014 book featuring a foreword by the actor James Franco, which promotes the idea of schools requiring students to invest 20% of their time in independent projects. Among her best-known students are Franco and Lisa Jobs, Steve Jobs' oldest daughter. Wojcicki not only teaches the children of the tech aristocracy, but is also the matriarch of one of Silicon Valley's most remarkable tech families. She is the mother of 3 adult daughters, Susan, Anne, and Janet. In 1998, when Larry Page and Sergey Brin founded Google as Stanford graduate students, Susan rented them space in her garage. Today, Susan Wojcicki is the CEO of YouTube, and among the most powerful entertainment moguls in the world. Her sister Janet is a professor of epidemiology at UC San Francisco. Anne, the youngest Wojcicki, is the co-founder and CEO of the gene mapping startup 23andMe, and was married to Google co-founder Sergey Brin. So Brin is Esther Wojcicki's former son-in-law, and they remain, she tells me, on very friendly terms. We happened to meet on what one of Wojcicki's students referred to as Moonshot Day, the day of the week when the Media Arts Center provides students with its facilities and resources to do their own special projects. So the multi-million-dollar media center, lined with the latest IMACs, has the feel of a high-tech newsroom rather than a classroom. Every so often we are interrupted by a student asking Wojcicki a question. Her tone with them is edgy and challenging. She resembles as much a newspaper editor or a life coach as a conventional teacher. I watch Wojcicki interact with the students, simultaneously cajoling and encouraging them, forever trying to mine their talent. It occurs to me that her illustrious reputation as a high school teacher, with all the awards and acclaim, is based on her ability to reinvent herself as part friend, part mentor, part parent, and part boss to the students. The U.S. managing editor of the Financial Times, Gillian Tett, in her influential 2015 book, The Silo Effect, argues that the most successful people of the future will be those who escape from traditional institutional or vocational categories. Wojcicki, herself sidestepping the conventional pedagogical silos and treating her students as little adults, is also preparing them for a world where, as Daniel Straub predicts, people will do 6 different jobs simultaneously. Not surprisingly, Wojcicki has very strong views about the failure of schools to educate kids for the 21st century. We are still training kids for the 20th century. The pedagogy is the same. Rather than training thinkers, we are training people who follow instructions. We are creating a nation of sheep, she says, referring to the teaching in most schools, including even that of some of her own colleagues at Palo Alto High. We've got to stop telling kids what to do all the time. Instead, we need to treat them the way we ourselves would like to be treated. In an age of AI, she says, it's particularly important for kids to feel empowered if they are to realize their potential. And so her goal as a teacher, she tells me, is to try to create technically proficient, confident kids who are willing to take risks and aren't afraid of failure. As we've seen so many times before in this book, it's all about trust. Trusting these kids is critical, she says. We have to trust them to make their own mistakes. Any kids, average or otherwise, she says, can learn from their mistakes. That's how she brought up her girls, Wojcicki says. I trusted my daughters with a lot of freedom, she confides. I set a model. I was a rebel. They did what I did rather than what I said. In fact, Wojcicki boasts, the origins of some of Google's most influential ideas can be traced to her child-rearing strategies. So, for example, Larry and Sergey got their 20% rule from my daughters, she says, speaking of Google's corporate policy of requiring its staff to invest 20% of their time in what it calls moonshot projects, such as driverless cars, delivery drones, smart homes, and robots. But to her, Sergey Brin and Larry Page are also models of risk-takers unafraid of failure who are able to think outside the box. Both Sergey and Larry went to Montessori schools, so they've always set out to accomplish what everyone told them couldn't be done. Wojcicki, an admirer of Maria Montessori's teaching method, reminds me. So in her mind, the innovative startup entrepreneur and the successfully educated student actually share many of the same attributes. Independence, a propensity to take risks, and a willingness to rethink conventional assumptions, take moonshots, and fix the future. Returning to Utopia. If there is a country that is a successful model for educating its citizens, it's that tiny tropical island on the southern tip of Malacca that aspires to become the world's first smart nation. In dramatic contrast with the United States, Singapore is teaching its children well. Just as it's the most connected country in the world, the world's only city-state island also might be the best educated. In the latest Program for International Student Assessment, PISA study, an influential test conducted by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, every 3 years involving more than 500,000 students from more than 70 countries around the world, Singapore was ranked first overall in all three test subjects, math, reading, and science. The United States, in contrast, didn't finish in the top 20 in any of the tests, limping in 35th in math, 25th in reading, and 24th in science. Education is all we have, and people are our only resource, are statements one hears often on an island where, as you'll remember, there are very few natural resources. In Singapore, 90% of its population of 5 million gets some sort of post-high school education, with 25% of Singaporeans attending university, 40% attending polytechnic, and 25% going to one of the country's three institutes of technical education, ITE, colleges. In many ways, these ITE colleges are Singapore's most notable achievement, the equivalent of Germany's much-vaunted apprenticeship system. The three ITE colleges offer two-year courses in digital media that are designed to give job skills to people who aren't academically gifted. The three colleges have more than 50,000 students, almost all of them subsidized by the government, which pays between $500 and $900 a year for their education. 90% of ITE graduates get a job within 6 months, many doing community service in Vietnam and Cambodia. After spending an afternoon touring one of the cavernous ITE colleges and meeting its enthusiastic students, I talk with Bruce Poe, a former Hewlett-Packard engineer who is the CEO of the whole system. "Government must take leadership," Poe exclaims, explaining the annual $470 million invested by the Singapore government in the three ITE colleges in order to create a digitally skilled workforce. "No skill equals no job. Without education, people would otherwise end up on the street," he tells me, adding that the government's investment in collaborative robots, known as cobots, will end up assisting rather than replacing workers in an increasingly automated age. One American who knows the Singaporean education system intimately is Tom Magnanti, a former dean of the School of Engineering at MIT, who has been living in Singapore for more than 20 years. Magnanti, who originally came to Singapore to run MIT's alliance with the National University of Singapore, is now the president of the Singapore University of Technology and Design, SUTD, an ambitious new $325 million university for 1,300 students, which opened in 2012. As a joint collaboration between MIT and the government, SUTD is known as the new MIT in Singapore. It sits on the opposite end of the education spectrum from Singapore's ITE colleges. Rather than teaching students basic technical skills, the goal of Magnanti's important new university is to produce exceptional 21st century leaders. "I view myself as an academic entrepreneur," Magnanti tells me when we meet on SUTD's gleaming high-tech campus near Singapore's equally gleaming high-tech Changi Airport. Rather than money, however, The value that Magnanti is trying to create as an academic entrepreneur is in human capital. As the founding president of SUTD, he is in the business of investing in technically literate and responsible leaders for the 21st century. Like that of Esther Wojcicki at Palo Alto High, Magnanti's goal is to realize the talent of his students. And like Wojcicki's Media Arts Center, Magnanti's new university is a moonshot project designed to reinvent the way we think about education in our network age. One of his goals with SUTD, he explains, is to challenge the conventions of traditional technical universities in terms of both its year-round academic calendar and its innovative curriculum. In its attempts to escape the academic silos of a typical technical university, SUTD doesn't offer traditional degrees in subjects like electrical or mechanical engineering. The interdisciplinary curriculum, instead, is built around the question, what products, services, and systems does the world need? It is designed, according to Magnanti, to create a sense of magic in the value of not only technology, but also the arts and humanities. What the world definitely needs, Magnanti tells me, is leaders. That indeed is the real purpose of the new university. Quoting Benjamin Franklin's remark that the best leaders need to understand technology, he adds that they should understand everything else too. And that's his goal at SUTD, to train citizens to become the leaders of the future in a world where we are increasingly asking what humans are good for. Indeed, the university's mission statement is to nurture technically grounded innovators to serve societal needs, and incoming students are selected according to portfolios, letters, and essays, as much as their formal academic qualifications. In contrast with MIT's Brynjolfsson and McAfee, Magnanti isn't a fan of MOOCs and online education. Physical education isn't going away, the still trim Boston native, who confesses that he always wanted to play right field for the Red Sox, tells me. I love these kids. I get such a thrill seeing them come here and leave 3 or 4 years later. That's what education is all about. Magnanti's personal commitment to SUTD is both impressive and moving. With a severely disabled 45-year-old son in Boston, Magnanti commutes between Massachusetts and Singapore and has done the 20,000-mile return journey more than 100 times. Leaders beget leaders. Tom Magnanti is not only the most frequent flyer on Team Human, he is also one of its most valuable members. Lessons from Moore's Law. In Silicon Valley, the answer, at first glance at least, to the question of education is simple. More technology. Coding, Apple CEO Tim Cook told President Donald Trump about the best way to reform the American educational system, should be a requirement in every public school. Cook's vision is being realized by Code.org, a nonprofit founded in 2012 by a couple of successful startup entrepreneurs, which has raised $60 million from Microsoft, Facebook, Google, and Salesforce. Code.org's goal is to make computer science as essential in the classroom as reading, writing, and arithmetic. Active now in 24 U.S. states, Code.org offers free online classes that have been tried by 100 million students worldwide, and has also provided training workshops to 57,000 teachers. But it's not just coding lessons that big tech wants to put into every school classroom. In the space of just a few years, reports the New York Times' Natasha Singer, technology giants have begun remaking the very nature of schooling on a vast scale, using some of the same techniques that have made their companies linchpins of the American economy. So, for example, Reed Hastings, the co-founder and CEO of Netflix, is championing an algorithmic math teaching program called Dreambox in several U.S. states, including Texas, Maryland, and Virginia. Mark Benioff, the CEO of Salesforce, is handing out $100,000 innovation grants to middle school principals in order to transform their thinking from that of bureaucrats into startup founders. And in more than 100 U.S. schools, Mark Zuckerberg is testing user-centric software, partly built by Facebook, that empowers kids to take control of their own learning and work with their teachers as mentors. There is no doubt, of course, that the often archaic education system needs to be radically reformed in today's digital age. That said, however, there are three major problems with this attempt by big tech to radically transform the traditional education system. The first is that the line between the public interest and the self-interest of these tech companies and individuals is often troublingly blurred, particularly in an education market that is supposed to reach $21 billion by 2020. So, for example, Reed Hastings is not only an evangelist for the Dreambox software, but is also what the Times' Natasha Singer calls the company's guardian angel, having donated $11 million in 2009 to a nonprofit charter school to enable it to buy the algorithmic platform. Second, the kind of philanthropy being practiced by Hastings, Benioff, and Zuckerberg is what Natasha Singer calls a singular experiment in education, with millions of students serving as de facto beta testers for their ideas. The American education system is essentially being reinvented in Silicon Valley's image. So, what Mark Benioff is trying to accomplish with those $100,000 innovation grants is a transformation of San Francisco schools into San Francisco startups. And what Mark Zuckerberg is doing by testing that user-centric software in those 100 schools is transforming the classroom into Facebook. It looks more a Google or a Facebook than a school, noted the CEO of a charter school network that is experimenting with Zuckerberg's software. But the biggest issue of all is whether the answer to the question of education really is more technology. It's all very well for other people's children to be educated by algorithms in Facebook-like classrooms, but when it comes to their own kids, then many of the most successful Silicon Valley entrepreneurs are much less evangelical about digital technology. As the New York University professor of psychology Adam Alter notes in his 2017 bestseller, Irresistible, many of the world's greatest public technocrats, including Steve Jobs, Twitter co-founder Evan Williams, and former editor of Wired magazine, Chris Anderson, are also its greatest private technophobes. Jobs, indeed, even discouraged his kids from using an iPad or iPhone. In Zurich, I ask Daniel Straub, who, in addition to being a former Montessori teacher, used to work as a business development executive for IBM, about the role of digital technology in the Swiss educational crisis. Was it the problem or the solution? I ask. Do kids need more or less technology to develop into responsible adults? Technology is moving so fast, and we are stumbling behind, Straub tells me, sounding like another influential early 20th century educational reformer, Rudolf Steiner, the father of Waldorf schools, the increasingly popular educational system that discourages the use of electronic screens. It's not inherently human to sit on the couch and watch television or go on the internet all day. Steiner was a turn-of-the-century Austrian philosopher and social reformer who invented an educational idea called anthroposophy, a kind of metaphysical humanism influenced by Goethe and Nietzsche, which stressed the importance of the independent spirit, imagination, and will in a child's development. In 1919, in the wake of Germany's defeat in the First World War, Rudolf Steiner gave a lecture about anthroposophy at the Waldorf Astoria cigarette factory in Stuttgart, which was owned by Emil Molte, one of his students. The lecture resulted in Molte's hiring Steiner to open a free public school based upon anthroposophical ideas for all the employees of his factory. Although Steiner died in 1925, the Waldorf school movement, like its Montessori counterpart, is an increasingly popular alternative to traditional education. There are now more than 1,000 independent Waldorf schools in 60 countries around the world. Like Montessori schools, the Waldorf teaching method focuses on nurturing the creative and moral development of young children. In contrast with Montessori's association of the idea of play with work, however, the Waldorf tradition focuses on the creative, emotional, and aesthetic development of the child. At Waldorf kindergarten schools, the teaching of reading and writing is put off till grade school. And, as in Moore's Utopia, children focus on interactive games, music, creativity, and physical play. At grade school level, Waldorf schools stress what they call social education, meaning the prioritizing of community values over individual competition. In America, Waldorf education is best known for its controversial attitude toward technology, particularly screen media. Television and the Internet are actively discouraged, if not banned, particularly in early grades. And much has been made of the growing popularity of Waldorf schools in the San Francisco Bay Area, particularly in Silicon Valley, where senior executives from tech firms like Google, Apple, Yahoo, and Hewlett-Packard are known to send their kids to these schools. In an age of increasing Internet addiction, online teen bullying, and social media narcissism, one reason for the increasing popularity of Waldorf education is its focus on the development of the child's self-control and social responsibility, the development of the will, meaning nurturing the determination, self-control, and commitment of the individual child, is central in Waldorf pedagogy. To say that Waldorf schools are teaching Moore's Law might be a slight exaggeration, but certainly the kind of duty-bound humanism that Thomas More preached in Utopia wouldn't be out of place in a Waldorf school. At my dinner with Nicholas Carr in Colorado, I ask him if he thinks alternative educational traditions, like Waldorf, can help kids manage their online behavior more responsibly. Although digital media isn't the technological version of fat or sugar, he answers, echoing the arguments of the New York University psychologist Adam Alter in Irresistible, kids are finding it increasingly difficult to control their Internet consumption. Ultimately, Carr acknowledges, the fix for a growing problem of online dependency and distraction has to come from users themselves rather than from the government. So, yes, he says, the Waldorf model should be investigated by parents who are concerned about their children's irresponsible or uncontrollable use of digital media. Esther Wojcicki, however, is more ambivalent than Carr. While sympathetic to some of Waldorf's educational principles, the head of Palo Alto High's Media Arts Center is, unsurprisingly, strongly opposed to the banning of technology in the classroom. The attitude I take toward Waldorf education, as a parent and as a critic, is similarly mixed. Both my kids, however, have attended Bay Area Waldorf schools. My son, as curmudgeonly as his father, found the focus on handwork, singing, and eurythmy, Waldorf's metaphysical version of calisthenics, intolerable, and left as soon as he could. I also failed dismally as a Waldorf parent. At one parent meeting for my son's sixth grade class, we were asked about our home media policy. As we went around the room, parent after parent boasted about not allowing the kids access to any media at home. One typically earnest Northern California couple confessed that they sometimes let their kids listen to classical music on the radio. When it was my turn to speak, I told the group that I actively encouraged my kids to watch movies on one of the many screens in my house. None of the other parents ever spoke to me again. But my academically gifted and highly motivated teenage daughter has thrived at Waldorf and currently attends the Credo High School in the nondescript town of Rohnert Park, some 50 miles north of San Francisco. Credo, which is now America's second-largest public Waldorf high school, was founded by Chip Romer, a one-time aspiring writer and co-owner of a comedy club, who originally became involved in the Waldorf movement as a parent. We meet in the school's new campus in a sprawling industrial estate on the edge of Rohnert Park. In contrast with Palo Alto High, there are no tech-rich new media complexes on the Credo site. And unlike Tom Magnanti's gleaming new university in Singapore, Credo isn't supported by hundreds of millions of dollars of government investment. Romer tells me that learning at the school is rigorous but meaningful, and that 94% of Credo's graduating seniors meet the academic threshold to apply to the intensely competitive University of California system. At the conventional local public high school, in contrast, only 20% of students qualify. The pedagogical focus, he says, is on the development of creative thinkers in preparation for what he calls a freelance society. Daniel Straub's world in which we have six simultaneous jobs. We talk about the idea of will in Waldorf philosophy.
I ask if it also might translate as agency, that word that has been featured throughout this book, from Edward Snowden's warning on the big screen in Berlin's Rote Teppich Fabrik, to the many members of Team Human determinedly working to shape technology for the benefit of their communities.
Yes, agency is a good word to describe our philosophy, he confirms. It's about building the capacity to achieve whatever you want. But it also comes with a sense of responsibility, particularly with being kind and respectful to others. Kids who struggle here have a lack of agency. So where does agency come from? It comes from practice and experience, he replies. It's like a muscle. The more you use it, the stronger it becomes. In response to the "what are humans good for" question, I suspect that Chip Romer would say that they are good at being good, at growing up into responsible citizens and caring people. That's also the goal of a Waldorf education, in which each child is treated as a discrete moonshot. And so, if we are to solve the plethora of challenges on the horizon, from wide-scale unemployment to the alienation and loneliness created by the always-on nature of our social media culture, we could do a lot worse than support alternative public schools like Credo. Waldorf schools certainly aren't perfect, and as I warned earlier, education shouldn't be considered the panacea for our digital ills. But given that there are no magical solutions to all these problems, a humanist school like Credo, with its utopian curriculum, is a perfectly imperfect place to begin to address how we can fix the future. Conclusion. Our kids. 19th century civilization has collapsed, warned Karl Polanyi at the beginning of the Great Transformation, his analysis of the shift from an agricultural to an industrial market society. Today, the next chapter of this great technological transformation is taking place, the early 21st century transition from an industrial to a networked operating system powered by the Internet. And today it's 20th century civilization that appears in some ways to be collapsing. We have seen how the deeply disruptive changes wrought by the Internet, with its new smart machinery, new modes of production, new types of economic scarcity and abundance, new models of work, new forms of culture, new educational systems, new inequalities and injustices, new definitions of wealth and poverty, are bewildering for those still clinging to 20th century realities. This is indeed the great transformation of our age, a complex journey that we are all navigating. I confess that the fixes in this book, like their human agents, aren't entirely perfect. The big data innovations in Estonia and Singapore will understandably make traditional 19th century style liberals, with their belief in an individual's intrinsic right to privacy, nervous. Even responsible regulators, like Margrethe Vestager, are occasionally prone to overregulate. Some of the innovative solutions we've outlined, like blocking online advertising, come with a whole new set of problems. A labor strike, led by multimillionaire artists like Taylor Swift, is obviously not a little absurd. Educating useless people for a world without work is, in some ways, a Sisyphean task. Relying on the super citizens of our Gilded Age like Jeff Bezos or Mark Zuckerberg to save the world is, to say the least, risky. And paying people to do nothing in an age of smart machines, as idealists like Rutger Bregman and the Union Square Ventures partner Albert Wenger want, is not going to automatically create a Marxian idol of farmers, fishermen, hunters, and critics. In contrast with Holbein's map of the little island of Utopia, our map is global. In the mid-19th century, the economic historian Eric Hobsbawm reminds us, Britain was the only genuinely industrialized country. 50 years later, Germany and the United States had overtaken it. And today, almost every country in the world has experienced its own industrial revolution. Much the same is true today of the digital revolution. True, it all began in Silicon Valley, that narrow peninsula of Northern California land between San Francisco and San Jose that has spawned Hewlett-Packard, Apple, Google, Facebook, Uber, and Airbnb. And true, the first 50 years of our digital history have taken place on Silicon Valley terms in what Carl Polanyi, critiquing the Industrial Revolution, called a utopian self-regulated market. But this libertarian model isn't sustainable. As we've shown, much of the real digital innovation in everything from new business models to